Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today it's Tom Holland talking on immigration in antiquity.
Thank you very much. I want to talk tonight about immigration, which, as we know, is an incredibly sensitive topic. And I suppose that if we're thinking about immigration as a crisis, immigration as something that is a challenge to policy formers, probably it's Germany that comes to mind. I mean, obviously, the crisis affected most of Europe, but it was Germany, really, that was the center of attention. And the crisis was obviously one that had, in a sense, been building for many years. You know, this flow of people coming up through the Balkans into Germany. And the way in which this crisis was presented, it wasn't just the sheer numbers of people crossing into Germany that made people feel nervous, made people feel alarmed. It was the sense that they didn't share the religion of the native Germans. They held very different traditions, and perhaps also the sense that what was attracting these migrants into Germany was a sense that the Germans were rich, that if you came to Germany, you could live well. And so inevitably, this was a huge challenge for the German authorities, and they tried various policies to try and stop the crisis before it came to a head. So there was a carrot, you know, subsidies would be paid. Basically, people would be bribed, given bungs, trying to persuade them not to come to Germany. And also there was a stick in the sense of kind of, you know, you beef up your frontier controls, you try and in some way regulate the number of people who are coming into Germany. But obviously, as we all know, nothing seemed to work, really. And in fact, the very attempt to control the flow of migration, in a sense, just seemed to kind of encourage more and more people to come in. And so, as a result, all these attempts basically were failed, and so the consequence was inevitable. Essentially, the crisis built to a head. And so, for the German authorities, basically, you know, they were staring down the barrel. The moment of truth was drawing near. The choice they faced basically was an incredibly stark one. Either they had to secure a definitive solution to the crisis, or basically they had to say, well, you know, we're going to give up. We're going to surrender the control of our frontiers altogether. And of course, as we all know, the storm did finally break in the summer of 955. Obviously, I wasn't talking about 2014. This is a history festival. That's exactly that's the kind of trick you must have had in every single speech. So we have a report of what happened in 955 from the 10th century equivalent of the sponsor of this festival, the 10th century German reporter for the Daily Mail. Wrote, a multitude of Hungarians, such as no living person can remember having seen in any one region before, invaded the realm of the Bavarians, which they devastated and occupied simultaneously from the Danube to the dark forest on the rim of the mountains. And there were two things in particular that filled the Germans with a sense of dread. One was the sheer size of the invasion force. This was a mass migration on a scale such as no one had ever witnessed before. And the second was the nature of the preparations made by the Hungarians. Previously, when the Hungarians had erupted into Germany, they had been migratory. The Hungarians were prodigious horsemen, and one of the particular talents they had was for shooting arrows while staring backwards on from horseback. And so they'd come flooding in, they would strip the countryside bare, they would grab as much loot as they possibly could, and then they would retreat back to the Danube before the more heavily armored German heavy cavalry could catch up with them. And so, you know, this was obviously an incredible annoyance for the German authorities. It was calamitous for those who were in the path of the Hungarian horsemen. But by and large, it was something that the Germans felt that they could, at a pinch, live with. But now it looked different because it looked as though the Hungarians were coming not just to raid, but to occupy territory. And spies that tracked the advance of the Hungarians reported that for the first time, as well as horsemen, there were large columns of infantry approaching, and that there were siege engines that were creaking and rumbling in their train. And so it seemed as if for the first time the Hungarians were coming with the goal of conquest. Now, what happened next in that summer of 955 is one of the key moments in European history, one of the key, most decisive clashes in the whole of the continent's history. The Battle of the Lechfeld is perhaps not tremendously well known. How many people here have heard of the Battle of the Lechfeld? Gentlemen in the front, take a bow, sir. You may, however, have, more of you may be familiar with its representation in the best-selling novel of the 20th century. Hands up those who recognize this scene. Come on, Lord of the Rings. This is the scene where Gandalf, defending the city of Minas Tirith, confronts the Lord of the Nazgul, who is leading the armies of Mordor through the gates that have just been shattered. And Tolkien drew for this episode on a chronicle that describes what happened when the Hungarians arrived before the walls of the German city of Augsburg. And we're told that the gates gave way, and the Hungarians were massing to sweep through, and Ulrich, the Bishop of Augsburg, wearing only his vestments, we are told, protected by neither shield nor chainmail nor helmet, stood in the gateway, holding up his crozier, saying, "You will not pass," as Gandalf says to the Lord of the Nazgul. And what then happened was that in the distance, the sound of trumpets were heard, battle horns, presaging the arrival of 3,000 heavy cavalry led by the King of the Saxons, Otto, a fabulously hairy man at a time where prodigious body hair was absolutely the measure of masculinity, so much so that Otto was in the habit of wearing a kind of t-shirt slit to his navel so that great tufts of hair could be seen. So he was absolutely the kind of guy that if, you know, you're in Augsburg and you're being menaced by Hungarians, this is the kind of guy you want to arrive. And Otto the Great, as he came to be known, I've slightly given away the result of the battle with that. Otto leads his cavalry charging down the hill, and it's a tremendous success. So again, those of you who've read Lord of the Rings will remember the riders of Rohan come to the rescue. But Otto is also a kind of simulacrum of Aragorn, who you may remember, again, those who've read it, apologies to those who haven't. He has a magical sword. Otto didn't have a sword, but he did have a magic spear. This was the Holy Lance, which it was believed had pierced the very side of Christ when he was on the cross. And Otto wielded it. His father had swapped an entire province for it and felt that he'd had a bargain in doing so. And the combination of 3,000 heavy cavalry and the Holy Lance meant that the Hungarians were trampled down and the entire invasion force was wiped out. And on the field of battle, above the screams of dying men, Otto was hailed by his troops as Imperator, a Latin word going back to the very early years of Roman history. It basically originally meant a victorious general, but of course it had also come to have a different meaning, what we would call emperor. And sure enough, in 962, so less than a decade after the Battle of the Lechfeld, Otto went to Rome and was crowned by the Pope as emperor, as Caesar. And it was a line of emperors that would continue pretty much unbroken right the way up until 1806, when Napoleon forced the ending of what had come to be known as the Holy Roman Empire. So why is this battle so decisive? Well, it's because the Hungarians were just one in a whole succession of peoples that for almost 1,000 years had been breaking across Western Europe. Essentially, the defeat of the Magyars ended a series of migrations that could be traced the whole way back to the reign of Marcus Aurelius, the emperor who is played by Richard Harris at the beginning of Gladiator. So that gives you some sense of the length of time. And by laying claim to the title of Caesar, what Otto was doing was saying to Christendom, to Western Europe, that the age of migrations was over, that the frontiers of Christendom were now stable, and that never again would the ululations of terrifying horse archers be permitted to chill the souls of decent Christians. And so it proved. It did turn out that a line had indeed been drawn under the age of mass migrations. The Hungarians became Christian. And within 50 years, their king, who'd taken on the impeccably Christian name of Stephen, the first Christian martyr, was being sent a diadem by the Pope and was being sent a replica of the Holy Spear by Otto the Great's grandson, Otto III, which tells you something about the originality with which German kings approached the task of naming their firstborn. And so this set the seal on two things that made Latin Christendom absolutely distinctive among the civilizations of medieval Eurasia. The first is that it was to an exceptional degree monocultural. Paganism effectively was wiped out. There was the odd community of Jews, but otherwise everyone within Latin Christendom essentially paid honor to the Pope. They were Catholic Christians. And the second thing that made it distinctive was that Latin Christendom, unlike the Caliphate, unlike the realms of northern India, unlike China, were from that point on secure against the depredations of horse archers. Even the Mongols, who wrought such devastation across, you know, the whole swathe of Eurasia, didn't penetrate into the heartlands of Latin Christendom. And by the 16th century, the age of discoveries, the boot was absolutely on the other foot. It was now Europeans who began to migrate to lands beyond Europe. It was not the people of other lands that came to this continent. And that remained the case for, you know, the 500 years that essentially followed on from the age of Columbus. And so in that sense, the current experience of mass migration in European terms is something fairly unprecedented. Western Europe hasn't really experienced anything like it for basically a millennium, since the time of the Lechfeld. And the only parallel really is with the period before the Battle of the Lechfeld. Because if you trace it back, I said that the approach of horse archers really begins with the reign of Marcus Aurelius. But if you're talking about waves of migration lapping across Western Europe, reaching even to Britain, then actually that is as old as the history of humanity within Europe. Obviously, the first wave of migration was that of the first modern humans. You think of the Neanderthals, finally they end up pent up in a tiny corner of Spain, down in a cave in Gibraltar, 24,000 years ago. That is their last stronghold, and then, you know, they're gone. Then the languages that the vast majority of us in Europe speak again bears witness to another surge of immigration, that of Indo-Europeans. Apparently, linguistically, within Indo-European languages, almost the only linguistic trace of the languages that were spoken before the coming of the Indo-Europeans is the formulation kn, so like knob. So knob is a trace element of what was here before the Indo-Europeans. And if we go into historical times and we look at the civilizations, particularly of Greece, the first literate civilization in Europe, almost all the cities of Greece traced their origins to migratory forefathers. So here we have this splendid looking chap, is the son of Heracles, the great the greatest of the Greek legendary heroes. And he in turn fathered enormous quantity of sons, and the Heracleids, as they were called, spilled across much of Greece and were the founders of a city as famous and celebrated, for instance, as Sparta. And it was held to be no disgrace. On the contrary, it was regarded as a measure of their martial quality, that the ancestors of Sparta and of many other Greek cities could trace their origins to people who had come and who had won their territory by spear. And so likewise, if you think of the great rival of Sparta, Athens, Athens proclaimed its distinctiveness by asserting, almost uniquely in Greek terms, that they had always lived on the soil of Attica, that they were autochthonous, they were sprung from the soil. And the Athenians told a frankly revolting myth to explain this. Do we have any people here under the age of 10? It's said that Hephaestus, the smith among the Olympians, had been filled with an incestuous passion for his virgin sister Athena, lunged after her, ejaculated over her, and Athena disdainfully wiped it off with a tissue and dropped it down onto the land of Attica, and that's where the Athenians came from. So, you know, anyone who wants to insist that there should be no migration might want to reflect on what that means about where we come from. Our land, Pericles famous said in his oration, our land, always the same people having lived here generation upon generation, our ancestors handed down to us by their own merit, free until now. So that's a more ringing, self-congratulatory way of framing that myth, the notion that the Athenians, almost uniquely, were not a people who had resulted from migration. And of course, what all these stories, these myths, these folk memories of the transformation from the Bronze Age into the Iron Age, what they are articulating is the fact that essentially cities attract people. That's what these stories are about. If you have settled communities that are able to generate surplus and then are able to invest that surplus in material wealth, that is always going to be attractive to migratory people who may not have things, physical objects, the glitter of gold to the same degree. And 279 BC, a great horde of Gauls, so from what's now France, migrating eastward. So it's not always just, you know, east to west. West to east also happened. Great surge of Celtic migration brought the Gauls to Delphi, the greatest of the Greek shrines. And we're told that the leader of the Gauls, to inspire his men, basically said, guys, there's great stuff in there that we can go and nick. To give courage to his men, he pointed out the enormous spoil before them, telling them that the statues and the four-horse chariots, of which many were visible at that distance, were made of purest gold, and that they would prove greater prizes when weighed than they appeared to the eye. So obviously, I mean, that's the kind of thing, that's the kind of ringing oratory you want if you want to inspire your men. The Gauls swept forward to go and grab as much as they could, but fortunately, Apollo and Athena came to the rescue and hurled boulders down at the Gauls, and they fled in disarray. Or did they? We don't know. That's what the Greeks reported. But a century on, fascinatingly, a Roman general who was starting to campaign in Gaul reputedly found treasures from the sanctuary of Delphi in a pool at Delphi. So there's a kind of, you know, we don't really know what happened. Was Delphi robbed or was it not? And it's interesting, it's actually a kind of similar ambivalence that we get in the most famous report of the capture of a city by Gauls, which of course is that of Rome, which in 390, another great horde of Gauls swept down into Italy, overwhelmed a Roman army, swept into occupied Rome. And we are told that only the capital, the great kind of hill at the heart of the city, managed to hold out. And you may remember the famous story that the Gauls try and climb up the side of the capital. The guard dogs are asleep and it's the sacred geese of Juno which hiss, which wake up the guards, and the Roman guards are able to stop the Capitol from falling. And it's a measure of how raw Roman memories of this were, that right the way up into the time of Julius Caesar and Augustus, on the anniversary of this supposed event, geese from Juno's temple would be put on purple cushions, put in a litter, carried around Rome in honour. A guard dog would be taken and crucified. It is also a measure of the terror that the Gauls inspired in the Romans, and possibly a hint that this whole story of the Capitol being rescued was a myth, that it was a requirement that from that point on that a reserve fund be held on the Capitol in case there be another invasion. And that was there right the way through the period when Rome starts to conquer the Mediterranean. Even as Rome is rising to a superpower status, dread of what Gallic invasion might mean was always there. And indeed, not just Gallic invasion, basically people coming from the north generally. So the late second century, a great horde of warriors from the frozen north, basically Denmark, descends, giant warriors from the kind of icy rim of the world is how they're described. They descend southwards, and they even more, they're taller than the Gauls. They are even more fierce. Their women, after a battle, roam around discovering those Romans who were left alive and castrating them. So these are really terrifying enemies. And that's why in 58 BC, when Julius Caesar goes to take command of the provinces that he's been given south and north of the Alps, Roman-occupied territory of Gaul, but there's still this vast expanse of unoccupied Gaul to the north. When he's confronted by a migration crisis, a tribe of people called the Helvetii moving, he is able to say to the Senate back in Rome, look, this is a Gallic migration crisis. I'm going to go in and I'm going to sort this out. And he goes in and he sorts it out to the extent that he then conquers the whole of Gaul, invades Britain, crosses the Rhine, annexes the whole region for Rome, despite the fact that under legislation that Caesar himself had passed only the year before, all this was entirely illegal. Caesar was breaking the law in conquering, his own law in conquering Gaul. But such was the dread that the Romans ancestrally had of these terrifying warriors that nobody really minded. The pacification of Gaul meant inevitably that the Roman frontier just moved northwards. It came to border the Rhine. And the attempts to pacify Germany did not work. Three of Augustus's legions were wiped out. Germany across the Rhine essentially was abandoned. And so what you had from that point on was essentially a militarized frontier. Now this ran directly counter to the way that the Romans liked to see themselves. The greatest poet writing in the reign of Augustus, Virgil, had this fabulous phrase, imperium sine fine, empire without limit. And ostensibly, this is what Roman strategists, Roman propagandists believed to be the case, that they were entitled to conquer the whole world. In reality, of course, they knew better. They knew that the whole world was not going to be Roman. And so therefore, in the centuries that followed the reign of Augustus, increasingly a conceptualization came to dominate the way that the Romans saw the world. There were Romans, and then there were barbarians. And the thing about this was that even conquered peoples, even Gauls, might in the long run become Roman. So there was the prospect that the whole empire might, in a sense, the Romans would no longer be a kind of ruling class. Everyone would become a Roman. And so there was, in the first century AD, there was a very passionate debate, which may sound familiar to us today to a degree, about the degree to which non-Romans could be integrated and become Roman. In AD 47, for instance, in the reign of Claudius, there was a proposal to make people from what was called long-haired Gaul. So in that very description, there was a sort of sense that these are barbarians with long hair. They don't have decent short haircuts like a Roman. Nevertheless, there was a proposal that aristocrats from long-haired Gaul might become senators. And we have Claudius's speech backing this up. It's recorded in Tacitus. And then portions of it were found inscribed on a bronze tablet in Lyon. So we know that this is, Tacitus wasn't making it up. This is genuinely Claudius's speech, and the fact that he promoted it like this meant that he wanted people to read it. This was his policy. And in his speech, Claudius pointed out that, sort of shades of the Guardian here rather than the Mail, that Rome had always been a city of immigrants. So it's like, Britain is a country of immigrants. Claudius was saying Rome has always been a city of immigrants. He said that, the founders of Rome were descended from Aeneas, a Trojan prince who had fled Troy to come to Italy. That Romulus and Remus, the founders of Rome, had offered what was called asylum, and that's where the word asylum comes from, to anyone who wanted to come. So the original Romans were people claiming asylum. Claudius's own ancestor, an aristocrat called Attius Clausus, he was an immigrant. He'd come after the founding of the Republic when the kings had been thrown out. And so this was the kind of ideology that emperors in the wake of Claudius increasingly promoted. And in 212, the logical conclusion was reached when an emperor called Caracalla, an incredibly unappealing man who murdered his brother, and just a massive shit. But interestingly, he became emperor in Britain, so we can maybe feel a little bit proud of that. And he was called Caracalla. Caracalla meant hoodie. So if you think of Caracalla as hoodie, he gave every free man in the empire the grant of citizenship. And so from that sense, it was kind of a massive triumph for immigration policy. Everyone became Roman. The effect of that, however, of course, was simply to harden the division, the conceptual division between those who lived within the imperium, within the empire, who could identify themselves with as being Roman, and those, the barbarians beyond, who were not. And yet there was, even here, paradox, because, of course, this division was incredible, in practice, in reality, was incredibly blurred. And that reflected the demands that there were on the Roman frontier system. It could not hold simply as a militarized zone. The Romans had to do more than that to stop the frontier from collapsing. And so what they did, essentially, was two-pronged. They would launch punitive attacks across the Rhine, across the Danube, against barbarians if they were causing trouble. But against that, there was also a concentrated policy to try and make these barbarians more Roman, to try and make them more sympathetic to what the Romans were about. And they would do that by essentially offering them bribes, employing them as mercenaries, educating the children of barbarian leaders so that they would be favorable to Roman culture. And the long-term consequence of this was that, in effect, what the Romans were doing was that they were state building. They were helping what had previously been diffuse tribal entities to consolidate and cohere and become little states that were just that little bit more Roman than they had previously been. And the more Roman they became, the more they came to appreciate what the empire might offer, and the more they wanted it. So again, analogy might be that the current migration crisis, particularly from Africa, is not so much a result of poverty as of rising living standards, because people can see on their mobile phones, they can see in film or television, what Europe has, and so they want a piece of it. And so there's a faint analogy there, perhaps. Now, what prevented the barbarians beyond the Rhine or the Danube from just crossing in? Well, it was the fact that Roman frontier policy was absolutely not as liberal as the European Union's is. It operated overwhelming military force, and it was absolutely prepared to use it should barbarians illegitimately cross the frontier. The only thing that would inhibit this was if the empire itself imploded into civil war, which is what happened in the 3rd century in the decades that followed the reign of Hudi Caracalla. 3rd century, the Roman Empire implodes, the floodgates are opened, and even as Roman armies are fighting one another, so barbarian hordes are crossing into the empire. The 4th century, order is restored, the frontiers are solidified again. Roman military force is as lethal as it's ever been, 350 to 353, for instance. The borders implode. The Emperor Julian, the apostate, the nephew of Constantine who rejects his Christian upbringing, the Battle of Strasbourg, he wins a sensational victory. 8,000 barbarians were killed, we're told. Roman losses, 243. So this, for the Romans, was absolutely like the good old days when they always won thumping victories. But the risk was always, for the Romans, of fragmentation. And the fact remained that the realms on the frontier were cohering, were becoming stronger. And so there was always the risk that if the Romans began to fight one another again, if the empire began to fragment and fracture again, then the sheer weight of these proto-states on the border might represent a challenge that ultimately would prove too much for the Roman authorities to control. And the dam broke in 378 at the Battle of Adrianople in what is now Turkey, Edirne. And it might seem as there's an element of the distant mirror about this. What happened was that Goths were being menaced in their rear by people who would emerge ultimately as the Huns. So really terrifying guys. So essentially the Goths were fleeing war, danger, menace. And they approached the Roman authorities on the Danube and they asked permission to cross. And the Roman Emperor Valens, he had a shortfall of troops. And so he thought, this is great. You can come over and I will employ you as what were called foederati, associated troops. You can fill up, you know, a gap in the Roman forces. The Goths were given permission to cross. Valens had no idea how many Goths were planning to come, because the moment he said, yes, you can cross, basically everyone crossed. So it was a kind of Merkel-esque quality to this. And the moment Valens realized what he'd done, he decided that he wanted to reverse this policy, and so he decided that he was not going to give the Goths a warm welcome. In fact, he was going to be thoroughly obstructive and unwelcoming. And so the Goths got cross about this, and they ended up going on the rampage. Valens tried to expel them, and it didn't go well. Here is Valens fleeing. He ended up, it is said, hiding in a stable where he was burned to death. And this meant that there was now a large, undigestible force of Goths within the fabric of the empire. And in the long run, this served to shred and annihilate the western, although not, of course, the eastern half of the empire. And it ended up being washed away in what I think one might legitimately call an immigration crisis, although it absolutely was not the barbarians who were the primary cause of the collapse of the Roman Empire in the West. Once again, it was essentially Roman dissension. It was the combination of disorder within the Roman West and the intrusion of very, very effective barbarian forces that combined essentially meant the fall of the empire in the West. Now, there is an irony here, because by this point, Roman citizenship, the citizenship that Caracalla had issued, was not the only thing that was uniting the peoples of the empire. Constantine, of course, had become Christian, and certainly by the 5th century, the whole of the empire had become very militantly Christian. And this was famously blamed by Edward Gibbon in the 18th century. He said essentially that Christianity had served to sap and weaken the fiber of the Romans, and therefore had played a key role in preventing them from manning up. They'd all gone soft because they were all busy praying and whipping themselves in caves. Actually, the opposite is the case. Insofar as the Roman Empire was able to cohere, it was Christianity that provided the glue. And Christianity was able even to reach beyond the limits of the empire far more effectively than any kind of notions of Romanitas had done. So in the 4th century, a guy called Ulfilas, he went to the Goths. And so the Goths who crossed over the Danube were already Christian. This is a kind of brilliant 19th century portrayal of the Goths. And we know that it's anachronistic because, of course, we all know that they didn't actually have horns on their helmets. And also, since the Second World War, no German artist would ever portray their ancestors like that. But it's quite fun. And the consequence of this is that Christian identity was massively able to outlive Roman identity. And if we're looking at antiquity as a kind of mirror held up to the state of Europe now, the varying responses to mass migration in Europe now. Everything I've been describing and to this point, you know, they are just kind of mirror images. They are kind of ghostly parallels. But with the coming of Christianity, we have something far more significant. We have something that explains, I think, the paradoxes of our response as Europeans to the spectacle of mass migration that we've seen over the past few years. Because on the one hand, in the wake of the collapse of the Roman Empire and the emergence of what are called barbarian kingdoms, but then become Latin Christian kingdoms, it's not just Otto the Great who pushes baptism, say, on the Hungarians. This is a policy that kings across Latin Europe, when they're confronted with barbarian intrusions, do. So Charles the Simple in West Francia does it with the Norsemen who will become the Normans. Rollo, the ancestor of the line of dukes that will culminate in William the Conqueror, he forces baptism on Rollo. Supposedly it wasn't tremendously successful. A few months after being baptized, Rollo goes and sacrifices a load of people, it is said, to Odin. So he obviously hadn't got the message. But Alfred does it as well, famously, with Guthrum when he defeats the Vikings. He forces baptism. And so Christianity becomes a way of... Christian kings can say to barbarian invaders, to Vikings, to Magyars, whatever, you can stay, but you have to accept baptism as a signal of your willingness to assimilate. And so there is that sense in which Christianity has provided a sense of identity that could be imposed on people who wanted to come in. Against that, there is another tradition that Christianity has given us that we still live with now. If we think of Angela Merkel's response in 2014, where, you know, she was confronted by a refugee, a girl, and the girl said, "Why can't I stay?" And Angela Merkel said, "Well, you know, I can't let everyone in." And the girl cried. And then a few weeks later, Angela Merkel said, "Yes, you can all come in." Now, Angela Merkel is a deeply Christian woman. She's the daughter of a pastor. And so she is, of course, incredibly familiar with the parable of the Good Samaritan. And the point of the parable of the Good Samaritan is precisely that a Samaritan who are regarded with contempt by the Jews of Jesus' time, it is the Samaritan who rescues a Jew. That's the point of the story. And for Christians throughout the early centuries of Christianity, right up until now, part of what for many Christians has been the point of Christian charity is that it should not just be for Christians. So I want to read out what a piece of writing that I think, in this context, does much to explain why Angela Merkel opened the borders and why there are so many people who do not want to just adopt the policy of a Roman general in the 4th century, close the borders, say no to people, even though they may be Muslim, they may have no cultural point of contact with the traditions of a Western European Christian country. It comes in the writings of a man called Gregory of Nyssa. Nyssa is a town in Cappadocia in what's now Turkey. And Gregory was a saint, father of the church, and he witnessed refugees. He witnessed migrants flooding through Cappadocia, and this is the passage that he wrote. And I think in the context of everything that's gone before, you will see that it is really something quite striking, something quite new. "We have seen in these days," Gregory wrote, "a great number of the naked and homeless. For the most part, they are victims of war who knock at our doors." So very like, you know, somebody might write now about the Syrians. "But there is also no lack of strangers and exiles, and their hands stretched out imploring can be seen everywhere. Their roof is the sky. For shelter, they use porticos, alleys, and the deserted corners of the town. They hide in the cracks of walls like owls. Their clothing consists of wretched rags. Their harvest depends on human pity. For meals, they have only the alms tossed at them by those who pass by." And alms, of course, A-L-M, not kind of alms. "For drink, they use the springs, as do the animals. Their cup is the hollow of their hand, their storeroom their pocket, or rather whatever part of it has not been torn and cannot hold whatever has been put into it. For a dining table, they use their joined knees and their lamp is the sun. Instead of the public baths, they wash in the river or pond that God gives to all. This life of theirs, wandering and brutal, was not that assigned to them by birth, but results from their tribulations and their miseries." And elsewhere, Gregory says quite specifically, he praises his brother, for instance, Basil, who is the founder of effectively the first hospital, and he praises his brother Basil for offering shelter not just to the sick who are Christian, but to Jews and pagans as well. And so they're inherited from the Christianity of antiquity. I think we have the explanation for the kind of torn, tortured, ambivalent response to the migration crisis that has characterized the whole of Europe. Essentially, it's a tension between our desire for security and about being obedient to our deepest and noblest ideals. So do we strengthen, maybe even militarize Europe's borders and let camps full of misery fill them? This is not a picture of the Chalk Valley History Festival. This is this is the jungle in Calais. Or do we allow large numbers of people from a very different culture into Europe without the certainty that they can be assimilated? And part of the problem, perhaps, is that we do not have the confidence that Alfred the Great, that Otto the Great had, that our culture is something that can be kind of imposed upon new arrivals. So the kings, the leaders, defeated by Alfred, defeated by Otto, when they were given baptism, they could have the sense that they were being ushered into the commonwealth of Christian people. There was the sense of the terrifying majesty and splendor and potency of the Christian God behind it, with angels, seraphim, cherubim, an overwhelming, haunting, poetic, powerful vision of the earth and of the heavens. What do we have? We have pamphlets that are handed out telling people, you know, don't grope people, don't grope women in short skirts. It's not it's not as potent as the vision that Alfred and Otto were able to draw on. So there, I think, looking at this in the broadest possible context, we see that Europe's response to this crisis, you know, there is going to be no solution that everyone is happy with, because culturally we are split. We are split between being Otto the Great, charging, you know, forcibly assimilating, and we are Gregory of Nyssa saying, yes, it is our moral duty to welcome people in, to feed and to clothe them, and not to impose our moral standards on them. And that ultimately, I think, is the value, perhaps, of history, is not that it gives answers, but that it shows us that actually, in many ways, answers are impossible to arrive at. Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.